and tyranny perpetrated by governments against the people. In this regard, the Messenger of Allah said, "The world will be filled with tyranny and injustice, such that there will be fear and war in every house." Imam Ali alayhi salam has also said, "The world will be filled with tyranny and injustice, such that there will be fear and grief in every house." Imam Baqir alayhi salam, the fifth infallible Imam, has said, "Hazrat Qaim," referring to Imam Zaman, Imam Mahdi, "will not rise up except at a time full of fear and dread." So brothers and sisters, this is what we are looking at. This is where we are headed. This is directly related to us, our lives, and our lifestyles. This fear and dread will mostly stem from the rule of despotic and obstinate rulers in the world before the advent of Imam al-Mahdi. In this regard, Imam Baqir alayhi salam said, "The Mahdi will rise up at a time when the helm of affairs would be in the hands of tyrants." Ibn Umar said, at the end of time, a noble man having wealth and children will wish for death because of the suffering and adversity he will experience from the rulers. So see, brothers and sisters, aren't we experiencing that lifestyle in today's time and age? Do we get a hint of that? Well, of course, we all can feel it. Maybe I'm not the target at the moment, but if I look around in the world, I see so many innocent human beings being targeted by these despots and oppressive rulers and their governments. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the state of affairs of the world at the time of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam and before he reappears, and the despotism of governments of the world, the oppressive governments and the tyrannical governments of the world. It is worthy of note that the followers of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam will suffer not only from aggression and encroachment of alien powers, but also from their own despotic and self-centered governments, in such a way that the earth, notwithstanding its expanse, will become too small for them. Instead of experiencing a sense of freedom, they will feel that they are in bondage. Even now in the Muslim world, many leaders in Muslim countries are not on good terms with Islam, and the Muslims are alien to them. Are we not experiencing that today? Is it not impacting our everyday lives today? What about our generations? What about our siblings? What about our relatives? What about our friends? Look at the evil Saudi government, which is bombing the innocent Yemenis. Look at the United States of America completely and shamelessly oppressing and bullying the independent nations of the world. Well, some hadiths have emphasized the Muslims' entanglements with self-centered leaders and give glad tidings of the advent of a universal savior after the rule of oppressive rulers. This set of hadiths has made mention of three types of governments that will emerge after the noble messenger of Islam. These three types of governments are, number one, the caliphate. Number two, the emirates and kingdoms. And finally, the tyrants. These three types of governments are ruling the world. Amongst all of these governments, all you see is a very small ray of light, a very bleak and very thin ray of light, and that is the Islamic Republic of Iran, the only system that is standing up for the oppressed single-handedly without any help from any of the other governments or even the people. General masses, as they come to know the role of Iran in the world, you know, let's say destruction of ISIS, which was at the hands of this divine system, they appreciate what Iran is doing, but the despots and tyrants, they don't like it. Thank you. dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Tour the pit.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
Islam, my deen.
Allah, my Lord.
His word, Quran.
Muhammad, prophet.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the merciful.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners and sisters and brothers from every single corner of the world, wherever you are, I hope you're doing well and everything is fine with you. This is IRIB English Radio, and today I have the privilege to be your host. Here with me, I have Brother Abdullah. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Hope you're doing well and everything is fine.
Alhamdulillah, can't complain.
So thank God. This is Youth Station, and we're going to have some very interesting topics for today. Well, now I have a private question, just to start the session. Have you ever checked on your children? You check their cell phones, check their diaries, I don't know.
Me, personally, with my kids, now they pretty much they're old and they moved on in their life. Have I checked? No.
How come? As parents, every parent, I think they would love to know what goes on in their children's head.
Okay, do you know why they love to know going on the children's
because
head?
They want to know if they're going wrong or no.
Yeah, but why?
Because they want the good for them.
No, it's just, you see, when a parent is wondering that, it means because they have let go of them to begin with. When you start to wonder what's going on in your child's life, it means because you are not involved in it. That's why you're wondering. If you're involved from the beginning, you wouldn't be wondering, you know exactly what's going on in their life.
You mean everything your children do, they tell you?
No. What they tell you is good. I mean, if you develop that special bond between them, that's wonderful. But if you don't, but at least sometimes some parents, they are from the beginning involved in their children's life. They know what's going on in their lives. So they wouldn't be wondering, I wonder what's going on. They would know everything. And, you know, they are in charge of things. For example, in terms of social media and devices, me as a father, I would install a parenting app on all the devices. I control exactly what they see.
You did that?
Yeah.
So you controlled them. You checked on them.
No,
so
that's what I'm saying to you. I make sure that they don't do anything haram or nothing that I don't like is going to their devices. Wherever they want to install, they have to get, you know, the apps ask for my permission. So I'm exactly in control of exactly what's going on. So I don't need to see or go check on them physically. I have
thank you.
Control.
You are doing something bigger.
So I have everything under control. And my kids, mind you,
you're controlling them from the first square.
Yeah. The thing is with children is themselves, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has programmed them to obey authority. Human beings in general, we need to have authority in our life. Otherwise, without authority, we'll go crazy, we'll go goo-goo. So with kids, especially with kids need to have authority. So they respect authority and they value authority if the authority is dealing with them justly. All right? So you explain to the child, explain to them that, look, this, the media, the world that we live in, is a very dangerous world, especially the social media. I can't allow people to come and harm you. So that's why we have a lot of bullying, online bullying, what they call it today.
Yes.
A lot of abuse. And we have so many suicide cases happened because some people got abused online, especially I'm talking about kids, mm-hmm. right, where they were extorted or, you know, we have so many girls who committed suicide because someone decided to put the pictures online and they have, you know, blah, blah, revenge. I don't want to bring that term. And people commit suicide because of that. So you have to explain to your kids that obviously we have a problem, so therefore we need to make sure that we are protected. And so from the beginning, if you enter their life from the beginning, you will need to check up on them. Like, do I need to physically check up on my daughter's journal? And no, I don't, because I know exactly what's happening in her life. And I taught her well enough that I don't even need to check. Well, I'm not with them in school. I'm not with them outside. I don't know what's going on in their personal details.
Yes.
But nevertheless, because I've raised them well enough that I know who they are and what kind of people they are. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I don't need to wonder. So I'm saying if a parent is finding himself wondering what's going on in his life, it means because they're not in control of their kid's life.
And do you believe that all the parents are the good criteria to know what's good and what's bad? For example, I'm using some sort of special apps in my cell phone, and my parent, my dad or my mom, tells me that this is wrong, you shouldn't use it. But how come she knows good and bad for me? How come she knows this is good or this is bad?
As kids...
Because, time has changed. Okay, also, children have their own mentality.
Yeah, so Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, don't teach your kids in the same way that you grew up because they were born in a time different than yours.
That is the point.
Yeah.
Well, here is where we're going for a little break. Hope you're not tired. Don't go anywhere. Stick to Youth Station. We'll be back in no minute.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So I had to take that into consideration that what I liked, what I loved is different than my kids, right? We had this Atari thing with just dots, but now they have like a full-on graphic, like high-definition graphic characters, which they almost look real. So I have to cope with that, not deprive them. Deprivation will never lead you anywhere. Most of the youth that I see, they're not educated. If you say to them no, they have no other way to deal with you besides blow up in your face. Now, there's a problem. They're not educated themselves. So, for example, I had to spend like days and days and weeks and months with a boy just to get him to understand that going to school is a good thing. His father's approach, you go to school or I'm going to punish you. He's not going to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me weeks until I got him to go to school willingly. You know, that's why Imam Sarq says, you know, اتركوهم سبعا صاحبوهم سبعا علموهم سبعا and then leave them, right? Mm-hmm. You have to let them go for seven, teach them for seven, be with them, befriend them with seven. And then by 21, you should see the results of your action. I mean, if you leave him completely and by the time he's 17, 18, 19 or even younger, and then he's having issues, teenage issues, and then as a parent, you have no idea how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. Well, is it his problem?
Of course, but we cannot put it that way because not always the parents are the guilty people.
If I want to be fair to parents, I would say 99% is their fault, the parents' fault.
Some youth are really stubborn.
Now,
you cannot shake sense
the
into
Prophet
their hands.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he went further. He says, "Choose لِنَطَفِكُمْ فَإِنَّ الْأَرْقَ دَسَّاسِ." The Prophet said, even the DNA of the woman, make sure that's accurate. So, you know, because now the science tells us that even moral traits, they get moved through the DNA too, not just the features. Even moral traits, generosity and bravery, they also come. That's why Imam Ali says to Aqil, his brother, he says, choose for me a woman that was born from the bravest of men. Why? Because he wanted to have a brave man.
To breed some bravery.
Yeah, exactly. From the beginning. From day one, you need to begin. From choosing the wife or the wife choosing the husband, that's where they have to begin. Right. Now, the youth, yes, sometimes you bring them perfectly all the way and then they themselves, they just don't want to work.
They go off the cliff.
That happens. But this is rarely.
So if, 99% is too much. I would say 70.
No, if the process is done correctly, believe me, the kids won't go wrong. See, that's the problem. It's not about being religious. You could be as religious as you want. Nuh alayhi salam was a prophet of God.
Mm-hmm.
And his son was what? Corrupted. We have imams who their kids were like bloodbaths. Some of the kids of the imam, like Zayd al-Nar. This guy, he burnt an entire village alive with the people.
So being a religious parent doesn't make the situation easier.
Exactly. So it's not about being religious. You will always have exception. A house, nurture, care, protection and safety. And my kids go to school, comes back. I've done my job.
But I have seen also parents who become their friend to their children, but also there are problems.
Oh, yeah. Well, who said becoming a friend with your child is a good thing?
So you're against it?
Of course. Islam is against
it.
We
shouldn't be friend with our
kids?
No.
Being friendly is one thing. Being a friend is another. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala appointed you as a mother and as a father as figures of authority. Not figures of friends.
You because stand the with minute, authority too much.
No,
but
no, because this is how Allah
works.
The children
nowadays do not think so.
No. See, when I say authority, it doesn't mean I'm not, you know, because sometimes we, the word authority, we automatically thinking dictatorship.
No, it's ruler.
It's not. So, for example, you could have the most peaceful, loving ruler authority. That authority is meant to make sure that your rights are given. That's what authority is. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And you as a person, you have to respect that authority because it provides you with your needs. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says to the parents, you are figures of authority, not figures of friends. If you become a friend with your child, what happens? You know what happens?
The child
will treat you as a friend and he will cross his limits. He will disrespect you because you're no longer a figure of authority.
Okay, but you will know everything about them.
No, being friendly.
You'll be a partner in crime.
That's what I'm saying. There's a difference between being friendly.
And being friend.
And being a friend. Mm-hmm. Okay? We have to be very friendly with our children to make sure that they're always with us. They're always coming to us with their problems. That we always know what's going on in their life. We are the one that helps them. They don't go mm-hmm. anywhere else. That's when we become friendly with them. To say I am a friend or I put myself in the position of his friend. No, I'm losing something. The child himself would, you know, this is where the danger happens. The child himself, since he no longer sees you as authority, he will seek someone else. Mm-hmm. He will, a girl would, you know, you see the girls who always try to, you know, go with older men.
Mm-hmm.
Because they lack the authority in their fathers. Because their father is so cool and chill, they don't feel like... She goes for a father figure. And same thing with kids who have tendencies towards older women, mm-hmm. or especially their teachers. I don't want my child to fall
into... So there must be a friendly atmosphere.
Friendly atmosphere.
Also authority.
With authority. Oh, yes, because Allah has put you in that position.
Mm-hmm.
Because like at the end of the day, Allah will question, like, what did you do? So I'm saying as parents, if we do everything correctly, let's say we have like 99% chance that our kids mm-hmm. going to be perfect or turn out to be right. Yes, being a human being, you're not infallible. You will make mistakes. You'll go here and there. That's mm-hmm. us obvious. And all of us, we all done our mistakes.
Yes, of
That's
course.
Just part of life. But we didn't
grow
go
and
too
learn
far,
things.
Though. Like, we didn't go too far. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? So if your parents do their job correctly, you should. But, you know, when you find yourself like facing a wall with your child, then obviously the prerequisites to upbringing a child are not there. And that's just a natural cause.
So rule in a friendly atmosphere and environment.
Well, I mean, look, being an authority figure is one thing. That's a topic for a different day. But educating your child and giving your child the proper upbringing is mm-hmm. what matters here. So which includes the authority. So when I teach my child all these things and all the things that he requires, he will learn along the way that I am the authority figure, right? So it's just natural. For example, when we learn about the Ahlul Bayt under the prophets, the more we learn about them, we learn about, you know, the things that they teach us. At the same time, they grow in our eyes and in our belief as authority figures. So we never question them. As the more we learn, this becomes an automatic process. It's like someone doesn't need to tell me, like, this is the imam, he must, you know, you must do exactly what he says, otherwise you will die. No, it automatically, it's like, as the more I learn about them, this figure automatically takes place.
So just to sum it up, we were talking about checking on our children as parents. We were discussing that checking on our children in a very direct way is not true. It's true that we must give them freedom, but also we have to be very careful about the way we upbring our children. The process is very important. We have to explain the good side and the bad side of everything. And in this way, there's no more need for checking them directly, going through their cell phones or their books, notebooks, whatever they write. We should rule in a friendly atmosphere. That's what I learned today. Thank you, dear listeners, for listening to us and having your ears and attentions. Until another session of Youth Station, may God preserve you from all the bad incidents. Thank you for listening.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The Yemeni army has conducted several strikes on targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates in response to what it calls the Sheikhdom's complicity in the crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Sana'a has promised to continue the cross-border strikes until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war in the country is ended. But how is the UAE involved in the war? The country has been supporting the so-called Southern Transitional Council separatists in southern Yemen since at least 2018. Those are the mercenaries that took control of Yemen's resource-rich Socotra Island in 2020. This move was a departure from its coalition partner, Saudi Arabia, who is only interested in keeping the Yemeni army away from its border. But the UAE has shown interest in controlling the port of Aden as well. Its focus is to have control over the important waterway, the Bab al-Mandab, an important oil shipping route.
Clearly, that's exactly the intention and the reason that Israel and is involved is partly because that also means that they have at least the approval, the tacit approval of the United States as well. So they think that the UAE thinks that this is the way that they will be able to control this sea route. They're also building a base on the island of Perim, or Mayum, as it's called, just off the coast of Taiz in Yemen. And it's actually, this is also Yemeni territory. But it's right in the middle of the Bab al-Mandab. It's right in the middle of the routes of 20,000 ships that pass through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
The Yemeni army has in recent weeks been fighting and liberating land from the separatists in the provinces of Shabwa and Marib. The UAE, Saudi Arabia's main partner in the years-long war that Riyadh and its allies have been waging against Yemen, to change the impoverished country's ruling structure. The military campaign has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire Yemen into the scene of what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The onslaught enjoys American military, logistical, and political support. The UAE is one of the most advanced air defense systems in the Persian Gulf region, but they haven't been quite successful at stopping the Yemeni army's missiles and drones. The Emiratis are now looking at South Korea, Israel, and France to supply them with additional weaponry and ammunition. In its largest arms export deal in history, South Korea agreed with the UAE to sell $3.5 billion worth of Cheongung II advanced medium-range surface-to-air missiles, along with accompanying radars. Abu Dhabi is also in talks with Tel Aviv to buy its missile system dubbed the Iron Dome. The UAE is also eyeing purchasing either Israel's Barak 8 or Spider missile systems. The systems will be installed in addition to American-made THAAD air defense batteries. And all of this comes in the backdrop of the U.S. playing a more prominent role by sending an aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the UAE. In one recent attack by the Yemeni army, the U.S. shot down the Yemeni army missiles. What does all this signal? Will this mean that the Emirates is bent on pressing ahead with its aggression against Yemen, despite the obvious losses of its mercenaries on the ground in the war-ravaged country? And the U.S., along with Israel, have promised support.
The UAE had its own goals in Yemen, which were not the same as those of Saudi Arabia. But they could only happen. The UAE could only fulfill its goals in South Yemen if there was, the Saudi Arabia succeeded in its goals in northern Yemen. That is, Yemen had to be torn apart and split between Saudi Arabian influence and UAE influence.
At any rate, the Yemeni army is vowed to continue to pound targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the war is over. The Yemenis are warning that the Emirates and its trade-based economy won't be able to withstand the attacks. As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The Yemeni army has conducted several strikes on targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates in response to what it calls the Sheikhdom's complicity in the crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Sana'a has promised to continue the cross-border strikes until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war on the country is ended. But how is the UAE involved in the war? The country has been supporting the so-called Southern Transitional Council separatists in southern Yemen since at least 2018. Those are the mercenaries that took control of Yemen's resource-rich Socotra Island in 2020. This move was a departure from its coalition partner, Saudi Arabia, who is only interested in keeping the Yemeni army away from its border. But the UAE has shown interest in controlling the port of Aden as well. Its focus is to have control over the important waterway, the Bab al-Mandab, an important oil shipping route.
Clearly, that's exactly the intention and the reason that Israel and is involved is partly because that also means that they have at least the approval, the tacit approval of the United States as well. So they think that the UAE thinks that this is the way that they will be able to control this sea route. They're also building a base on the island of Perim, or Mayum, as it's called, just off the coast of Taiz in Yemen. And it's actually, this is also Yemeni territory. But it's right in the middle of the Babel Mandab. It's right middle of the routes of 20,000 ships that pass through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
The Yemeni army has in recent weeks been fighting and liberating land from the separatists in the provinces of Shabwa and Marib. The UAE is Saudi Arabia's main partner in the years-long war that Riyadh and its allies have been waging against Yemen to change the impoverished country's ruling structure. The military campaign has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire Yemen into the scene of what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The onslaught enjoys American military, logistical, and political support. The UAE is one of the most advanced air defense systems in the Persian Gulf region, but they haven't been quite successful at stopping the Yemeni army's missiles and drones. The Emiratis are now looking at South Korea, Israel, and France to supply them with additional weaponry and ammunition. In its largest arms export deal in history, South Korea agreed with the UAE to sell $3.5 billion worth of Cheongung II advanced medium-range surface-to-air missiles along with accompanying radars. Abu Dhabi is also in talks with Tel Aviv to buy its missile system dubbed the Iron Dome. The UAE is also eyeing purchasing either Israel's Barak 8 or Spider missile systems. The systems will be installed in addition to American-made THAAD air defense batteries. And all of this comes in the backdrop of the U.S. playing a more prominent role by sending an aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the UAE. In one recent attack by the Yemeni army, the U.S. shot down the Yemeni army missiles. What does all this signal? Will this mean that the Emirates is bent on pressing ahead with its aggression against Yemen, despite the obvious losses of its mercenaries on the ground in the war-ravaged country? And the U.S., along with Israel, have promised support.
The UAE had its own goals in Yemen, which were not the same as those of Saudi Arabia. But they could only happen. The UAE could only fulfill its goals in South Yemen if there was, the Saudi Arabia succeeded in its goals in northern Yemen. That is, Yemen had to be torn apart and split between Saudi Arabian influence and UAE influence.
At any rate, the Yemeni army is vowed to continue to pound targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the war is over. The Yemenis are warning that the Emirates and its trade-based economy won't be able to withstand the attacks.
Meet the latest addition to Iran's diverse missile arsenal, Khaybar Shekan, a state-of-the-art missile unveiled earlier this week. It can strike its targets within a range of 1,450 kilometers with pinpoint precision. The ballistic missile is solid-fueled and therefore will be ready for launch much faster than liquid-fueled projectiles. It's even much faster and lighter than other Iranian solid-fueled models and can carry a powerful warhead. Ballistic missiles fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory. This makes them vulnerable to interception by air defense systems. But Iran's armed forces say Khaybar Shekan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for any advanced missile shield. Iran has been manufacturing various types of military equipment and weapons, including missiles, despite many rounds of Western sanctions against its arms industry and other sectors. Missiles are one of the cornerstones of Iran's defense doctrine. Iran has the Middle East's most diverse arsenal of projectiles, from very short-range rockets to advanced ballistic and cruise missiles with pinpoint capabilities. Iran has been working hard to enhance them, both in terms of range and precision.
Iran is merely trying to keep up in order to defend itself. I mean, I'm sure Iran and the Islamic Revolution would like to spend that money elsewhere. But as long as you're being threatened, it is necessary to develop yourself to a degree in order to be able to have that defense. You know, you can have all the greatness that you want, but if you're not capable of defending it, you'll eventually lose it.
The Iranian pursuit of more advanced projectiles has been relentless. It makes no secret of it, because Tehran says they are a must for effective defense in the world's most dangerous region. But how did Iran master the technology to produce advanced projectiles despite decades of sanctions and import bans imposed by the West? The Iranian missile program grew out of the war initiated by the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense. Iranians argue that they had no choice but building their own defense industry domestically and independently. The latest Iranian achievements are a far cry from the earliest models. Meanwhile, the West, especially the United States and its close allies, have described Iran's missile arsenal as a threat. They have tried to push Iran to abandon it, but Iranians seem to have learned to listen from the past and insist that their defensive missile power is a red line that will never be negotiated.
There has been a great deal of growing hostility towards Iran from the imperialist powers, and that in doing so, they have forced Iran to develop greater and greater weapons with the capacity to defend themselves. They are under assault from imperialism, and this is a constant ongoing threat from the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia, who have formed the imperialist bloc inside of the Middle East.
When repeated Israeli threats against Iran are taken into account, the need for a robust defense program seems more urgent. Iran says its military might will enhance regional security. It also insists that it will never start a war, but if attacked, a crushing response will definitely follow.
Talks are resumed in Vienna to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. This is the eighth round of such talks in the Austrian capital. The U.S. has so far failed to remove its maximum pressure sanctions, which it imposed on Iran after the former pulled out of the JCPOA, and give guarantees that a future administration will not ditch the deal again. Now Iran's top security chief said that there is no coherence coming from the U.S., on the revival of the 2015 Iran deal. Ali Shamkhani has stressed that the U.S. administration cannot impose the cost of its internal disputes on Iran.
And I think that now what we are witnessing is a division internally in the United States in the political establishment, both Democrats and Republicans, regarding a resolution to the ongoing situation with Iran regarding whether to go back to the table and to rejoin the JCPOA. We know that Biden has made overtures, and the State Department has said that they would grant some concessions in the forms of sanctions waivers. But like many Iranian commentators and politicians and diplomats have said, it doesn't go far enough.
Voices from the U.S. government show that there is no coherence in the country to make political decisions in the direction of advancements in the Vienna talks. The U.S. administration cannot pay for its internal disputes by violating Iran's legal rights. And voice from Iran and the P4 plus 1 group of countries, Britain, France, Russia, and China plus Germany, have been holding negotiations in the Austrian capital for 10 months in a bid to resurrect the JCPOA.
And I think that there's not much appetite for a deal with Iran at this point. I think the Trump administration did tremendous damage to the JCPOA by removing itself from it.
The new round of talks comes amid rising hawkish voices in the U.S. A group of 33 U.S. Republican senators, led by Senator Ted Cruz, wrote a letter to President Biden warning him that any deal with Iran on restoring the JCPOA requires Senate approval. The senators warned Biden that they will do everything in their power to block a possible deal if he moves forward without them. They also said that the implementation of any agreement will be severely if not terminally, hampered if the Biden administration does not fulfill a range of obligations in relation to congressional oversight over any agreements. The Republican senators said that if there is a deal that does not have Senate approval, it would be subject to being reversed as soon as there is a new president.
We see that the United States has been belligerent and has continued to put what it calls a maximum pressure campaign on the Iranian people, on the Iranian state, on the legal and legitimate Iranian government. And we see it as a web of coordinated activities by which we also know that Israel and the Zionist lobby are also pushing very heavily in the United States, in Washington.
The former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally left the JCPOA in May 2018 and reimposed the anti-Iran sanctions that the deal had lifted. He also placed additional sanctions on Iran under other pretexts not related to the nuclear case as part of his maximum pressure campaign. The pressure campaign was led by the Israeli and Arab lobby groups in the U.S. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it is willing to compensate for Trump's mistake and rejoin the deal, but it has retained the sanctions as leverage.
So I think that the internal divisions in the United States politically will continue to give free rein to the national security state in the United States to continue to put maximum pressure on Iran. But we know very well that Iran is a sovereign country and it will defend itself.
Iranian officials have repeatedly stressed that the onus falls on the U.S. to remove all illegal sanctions against the Islamic Republic in a verifiable manner and guarantee that a new U.S. administration would not breach the JCPOA again.
In the limelight.
As U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar led condemnation of a reported Biden administration plan to permanently seize $7 billion of currently frozen Afghan assets and distribute half to relatives of 9/11 victims, advocates pointed to the worsening humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan and urged President Joe Biden to change course. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Ilhan Omar Blasts Unconscionable Biden Plan to Seize Afghan Assets. Stay tuned for more. As U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar recently led condemnation of a reported Biden administration plan to permanently seize $7 billion of currently frozen Afghan assets and distribute half to relatives of 9/11 victims, advocates pointed to the worsening humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan and urged President Joe Biden to change course. Noting that there wasn't a single Afghan among the 9/11 hijackers, and the U.S. gives billions of dollars to Saudi and Egyptian governments, despite their direct ties to the 9/11 terrorists, Omar tweeted that punishing millions of starving people is unconscionable. Omar said she agrees with Barry Amundson, a member of 9/11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, who lost his brother in the Pentagon attack, who warned the proposed seizure would cause further harm to innocent Afghans. Omar tweeted, "That's exactly what will happen." Khaled Beydoun, an Egyptian-American scholar, tweeted, "This is theft, graft amid famine, no less. News flash, zero of 9/11 terrorists were Afghan," he added. "This is absurd." The advocacy group Afghans for a Better Tomorrow said in a statement that the proposed redistribution of Afghan funds is short-sighted, cruel, and will worsen a catastrophe in progress affecting millions of Afghans, many of whom are on the verge of starvation. Taking money which rightfully belongs to the Afghan people will not bring justice, but ensure more misery and death in Afghanistan. The group, which is circulating a petition aimed at convincing the administration to immediately unfreeze some of the funds, asserted. Phyllis Rodriguez, whose husband died in 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center in New York City, and who is also with Peaceful Tomorrows, was among those urging Biden to reject the proposed policy. She said, "President Biden has the opportunity to make amends right now. He can unfreeze the funds belonging to the Afghan people. They're not the Taliban's property, but of everyday folks like us. Let's see this as a humanitarian crisis that we can address immediately." Others noted the dire conditions the Afghan people are currently enduring. Masuda Sultan, an Afghan-American author and activist with Unfreeze Afghanistan, said that Afghans are experiencing a historic famine within a pandemic, and their economy has been in a free fall worse than the Great Depression. She added, "One of the main drivers of the economic collapse is the freezing of their assets. If the funds are not returned and the famine is not averted, America will be blamed for one of the worst famines in history." Rodriguez said that, "It saddens me that there are 9/11 family members who can see discrepancies in our relative privilege to demand reparations instead of recognizing the dire need of Afghans." She continued, "They have suffered unjustly for the actions of a cadre of extremists, a tiny minority of the population. Major famine, disease, displacement, and destruction that the U.S. government and its allies created should be reversed through all means possible." Miriam Benjamin, co-founder of the women-led peace group Code Pink, said in a statement that taking funds that rightfully belong to some of the poorest people in the world who are now facing a catastrophic famine is a cruel move that will not bring justice to the 9/11 families. Referencing the U.S. occupation that Biden ended last year as the Taliban retook the country, Benjamin tweeted that taking billions of dollars away from starving Afghans would be a fitting end to 20 years of screwing the Afghan people.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
Our dear youth, who did not see nor feel the revolutionary era, should pay careful attention to these details. They must come to realize the issue behind this, U.S. animosity, and the main cause of it. If a people do not know what their main problems are or why, they will be misled. The concern for the U.S. is that the revolution came and saved the country from morasses of different types. From morasses of dependence, backwardness, political and moral corruption, and global humiliation. We were suffering in these models. We had become dependent, humiliated, and backward. We were held behind. They held us back in scientific fields, in economic pursuits, technological advancements, on an international presence overall, in everything. And in return for these setbacks, we had American and English mistresses and sirs as our overseers.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In those days, we used to export oil 4 times more than the present time. Moreover, the population was half the size of today's population. However, most areas of the country were deprived of public and governmental services. It is the duty of governments to provide such services. The country was wallowing in poverty, backwardness, and moral corruption. Iran was in a terrible state, including all the infrastructure of the country. In the area of roadways, water-related issues, electricity, gas, public schools, universities, and civil services, it was suffering from a state of backwardness and poverty in all social, political, and economic areas. They used to offer up the country's natural resources of wealth to foreigners. It was only the ruling government that benefited from this situation. If the people spoke against their policies, they would silence the people by deception or either by methods of harassment or intimidation. Nevertheless, the people were angry, and they could see the reality of the situation. The result was that they followed our magnanimous Imam's spiritual and divine call, which led to the revolution.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh,
guided me from all the
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Millions of U.S. dollars have been approved recently by the Israeli regime as part of a plan to connect illegal settlements in occupied East Al-Quds with those built in West Dahali City. This was revealed by Israeli media days after the regime's foreign minister Yair Lapid stated that Israel won't build a new settlements that will impede a future two-state solution, but only settler homes will be built in existing settlements across the occupied territories. Settlement watchdog groups said such statements are meant to deceive the world as settlement activity goes on behind the scenes.
What Lapid is saying is just like playing with the words, you know, but it's so clear and obvious that what's happening in Jerusalem is an ethnic cleansing that's going on and Judaizing the city itself. You know, when they are talking about linking the settlements and the outposts in and around Jerusalem with the real way to connect it with West Jerusalem, is just to make it a surrounding of West Jerusalem, and dumping the whole Palestinian communities in East Jerusalem.
Israel's finance committee has approved a plan worth $310 million in order to link settlements in West Al-Quds with the other settlements in East Al-Quds, where the majority of its residents are Palestinians. The plan also includes expansion of the light rail, roads, and infrastructure construction that would be only serving the settlers. Palestinians say this plan will further undermine the feasibility of East Al-Quds as the capital of the future state. Tel Aviv has done everything possible to minimize the Palestinian population in the Holy City and in Area C that constitutes about 60% of the occupied West Bank. Experts say what Israel is doing is annexation of Palestinian lands without official declaration. Observers say that Israel is moving ahead with settlement construction and is erecting new roads to only serve settlers, while at the same time, the occupying regime is squeezing Palestinians out of their land, their ancestors' land, to make their dream of an independent state impossible. Mona Kandil, in front of the illegal settlement of Pesigot, occupied Ramallah.
Coming out in the cold to make sure everyone gets to keep their home warm in winter, amid the soaring cost of living in Britain. The government here blames the skyrocketing cost of living on global energy price hikes. These protesters, however, say it's the big companies that have made windfall profits who should foot the bill, not them.
Shell made £14 billion of profit. £14 billion. And BP made £10 billion. Why not take some of that and use that to pay for it?
They need to subsidise those bills. Why not? They've already written off $9 billion on PPE. They've written off $4.9 billion on bad debt, bad COVID loans, bounce-back loans. So subsidise us.
The country's energy regulator, Ofgem, has risen the price cap in place to protect the people by more than 50%. The government has introduced a loan scheme to help out, up to $270 per household. But experts say the underlying drivers remain.
There are already a lot of people struggling to keep their homes warm, particularly those who live in houses that are not properly insulated. And the recent price hikes are expected to push as many as a quarter of UK households into fuel poverty.
Rising bills will affect millions, but they'll bite the hardest for those with fewer choices. Add to that a tax rise set to kick in come April.
It doesn't have to be tax all the time. We need to have something to be given to us as well. It's like the benefits are not there anymore for us. So you go to work and you're still ending up being in a situation that, where should I go? I can't afford this, I can't afford that. And every year, is situation just getting worse and worse.
Someone young and starting off, you know, ready to buy a house and earn a living, it does make me quite worried, especially living in London. Cost of living keeps on rising. wage is not really reflected in that. So, I mean, I am quite worried about my future and the high cost of living.
Millions of British households will soon face energy bills of more than $2,000 a year. Whether